We live in a world where more and more of our everyday items have become disposable. When I was a little boy, I used to see my dad shaving every evening. He preferred to shave at night so he could hurry to work the next morning with as few chores as possible. He always used a metal, double-edged razor, the type which allowed you to change out the sharp, flat blades when they became dull. But the razor itself was never thrown out. Dad used it month after month and year after year. Since those ancient days, America has become a throwaway nation. Who would ever use a permanent razor these days? Like nearly everyone else, I use a little plastic razor in the morning. I've never followed Dad's shave-at-night practice. And when the razor gets dull, I simply throw it in the trash and pull out another one from my bag of a dozen razors. And when the bag is empty, the next time I go to Walmart, I buy some more razors, and I'm good to go. Restaurants used to serve meals in heavy bowls and use real mugs for the coffee. Of course, some still do, but millions of fast food joints have sprung up all over the world that provide us with hot breakfasts, lunches, and dinners wrapped in paper, with coffee and soda in paper or styrofoam cups. We finish our meals, put all the trash on our tray, and empty it into the large trash containers before walking out the door. We eat with disposable knives and forks. We wear disposable $10 watches, which we promptly trash as soon as the battery runs down. Stuff our sandwiches in disposable sandwich bags, wipe our mouths with disposable napkins, quench our thirst with water in disposable bottles, and sometimes print our documents on printers so cheap we find it more efficient to throw them away and buy another rather than pay for overpriced ink cartridges. Critics have suggested that our gravitation toward all things disposable is having a terrible effect upon our environment. But in this study, we're going to look at a far more devastating aspect of the disposable phenomenon, throwaway people and relationships. Those who experience new life in Jesus Christ quickly discover that God is all about relationships. Contained within Jesus two great commands, to love God with all our heart and to love our neighbor as ourselves, is the concept of relationships. Although some people don't seem to get this, the truth is that there is no such thing as love without relationship. I've seen singing competitions on TV with someone from the audience shouting to the contestant, "We love you!" The contestant will usually smile and reply, "I love you too." But of course, that's nonsense. The audience members and the singer have never met each other and have no relationship at all. Love between them is not even remotely possible. We may love the way someone sings and find their looks and their personality attractive, but to call that love is absurd. Where there has been no conversation, where people have never eaten together, laughed together, had agreements and disagreements, and made plans for future events and outings, love is nothing more than a word. We live in a huge world filled with billions of inhabitants. We cannot possibly know all these people or love them, except in a very hypothetical sense. Within all these masses, however, there are a very tiny percent that we get to know beyond the level of acquaintance. And with just a few of these folks, we have the chance to know them really well and form deep and lasting relationships. Primary among these would be the people with which we live, our spouses, our children, or any others that may sleep under the same roof as we do, eat at the same table, sit on the same couch, and watch the same television. These usually make up our closest relationships. From there, we have brothers, sisters, cousins, uncles, aunts, grandparents, grandchildren, friends, co-workers, and so forth. We'll relate to many of these people for the rest of our lives, or at least we should. The problem is that far too often we treat people pretty much the same way that we treat the paper cups that hold our coffee. We throw them away when they no longer seem to be of much use. In life, we face many opportunities for failure. Failure at our jobs, failure in our businesses, failure to live up to the goals we set for ourselves in our youth. But the greatest of all failures is the failure of broken relationships. Relationships where the lines of communication have been drastically and permanently severed. This would include marriages which have been dissolved through the moral epidemic of divorce, parents who no longer talk to their children and children who never call or visit their parents, brothers and sisters who haven't seen or spoken to each other in years or decades, and friends who used to confide in each other on the most intimate levels, now never talking, never calling, and trying hard to never think of one another. We justify our actions by telling ourselves that we've moved on, when in truth we've simply given up. The most intimate, the most challenging, the most rewarding, and sometimes the most painful of all relationships is the marriage relationship. For most of Earth's history, marriages were for life. There were a few good marriages, lots of mediocre marriages, some terrible ones, but divorce, which represents the total failure of a marriage, was pretty rare. It has only been in the last couple of generations when divorce went from rare to common, and ultimately to our current state of being normal, shameless, guiltless, simple, and easy. If Mr. Right starts acting like Mr. Wrong for more than a few days, cut him loose and go find your true Mr. Right. And if the next Mr. Right does the same, repeat steps A and B. Eventually, you'll surely find Mr. Really Right, or else you'll get so old and tired that you won't care anymore, and you'll settle for Mr. Not So Bad. God, who knows our hearts, anticipated our eagerness to look for an escape clause and has made it clear in His Word that once the vows have been exchanged and the physical intimacy begun, the exit door is shut, sealed, and double-bolted. In just the second chapter of the first book of the Bible, we read that a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. This speaks of the permanent union of a man and a woman who agree to live together, work together, play together, laugh together, and cry together as long as we both shall live. Jesus confirmed this, capsulizing his view on the matter with these words, "What God has joined together, let not man separate." Sexual unfaithfulness was the only reason Jesus allowed for legitimizing divorce and remarriage. This is about as far away from our current American attitudes and practices as it is possible to get. Two terms couples have traditionally used in their divorce papers are irreconcilable differences and the term irretrievably broken. What these really mean is that at least one person has entered marriage with stars in their eyes, only to wake up to reality in a short time with a terrible revelation. The person they married has some significant flaws. In fact, he or she has some aspects of their personality that are downright unpleasant. The other party has nobly tried to fix these flaws and correct the blemishes, but it has turned out to be an impossible task. Their spouses show every evidence that they'll live out their lives and go to their graves with these issues. This was not something that they signed up for. These irreconcilable differences are just too much of a burden, and divorce is the only solution. Another marriage bites the dust. Another man or woman has been thrown into the trash bin. Time for a new and improved model. In some cases, it's not even some major irritation. One spouse simply decides that they've grown apart over the years, which is code for, "I don't feel for him or her like I used to, and I want to give it another try with someone more exciting." All over our nation, there are millions of people eating, shopping, driving, and working who are throwaways. At the beginning, the pain is the most severe psychological agony the human mind ever has to endure. In time, it will dull, but short of divine healing, it will never entirely leave them. But this is not a phenomenon we see only in the realm of marriage. It happens between close relations of all sorts. The trouble with close relationships is that our frequent interactions create innumerable areas of potential conflict. If we go to the baseball game and sit beside a total stranger, we may say a few things to them over the course of the game, but it's unlikely we'll get involved in some fierce argument and end up screaming at each other. We don't expect much from them, and they expect little from us. We exchange a few words, cheer our team, leave the stadium at the game's end, and never expect to see them again. But with relatives, co-workers, and close friends, it's entirely different. We do see them again and again. We talk with them all the time. We discuss. We debate. We kid them, and they kid us. We feel comfortable enough with them to disagree when we feel they're wrong, and to strongly disagree when we feel they're way off base. And sometimes, when the conflict reaches a fever pitch, we withdraw. We stop talking, and we stop seeing them. Sometimes we realize that we're being silly and resume the relationship. But in some cases, we don't try, and they don't either. A month passes, 2 months, 6 months, a year, 2 years. And if we're not careful, we find that we've turned our brother or sister, son, daughter, friend, or neighbor into a disposable person. Like the styrofoam coffee cup that's empty, we've thrown them away, never to be retrieved. Our Heavenly Father is not pleased. Again and again He tells us to bear with each other and to endure the annoying ways, habits, and attitudes of those that He's placed in our lives. In Ephesians we read, "Walk worthy of the calling with which you are called, with all lowliness and gentleness, with long-suffering, bearing with one another in love." In Ephesians 4:32, Paul writes, "Be kind to one another, tender-hearted, forgiving one another, even as God in Christ forgave you." And in Colossians 3, he writes, "Therefore, as the elect of God, holy and beloved, put on tender mercies, kindness, humility, meekness, long-suffering, bearing with one another, and forgiving one another, if anyone has a complaint against another, even as Christ forgave you, so you also must do." Rather than destroy relationships when problems arrive, Christ calls us to tenderly bear with that person in humility, and by all means preserve the relationship. Sometimes Christians, knowing that Christ calls us to forgive, will say to themselves, "Well, I forgive this person, but I don't ever plan to call them or see them again." It's amazing how we can justify our disobedience. Here we have the unforgiving forgiver, the one who breaks relationships all the while professing their forgiveness and Christian love. Any forgiveness which refuses to ever have anything to do with the person you claim that you've forgiven is no forgiveness at all. Aren't you glad God doesn't treat us that way? We've all broken relationship with our Holy Creator. We've offended Him in our words, deeds, and attitudes. Still, in divine humility, Christ reaches out to us, offering forgiveness and the restoration of the fellowship that God desires with His stumbling, sinning, rebellious children. As Jesus died in agony on the cross, God was saying to the human race, "We can still be friends. You can be forgiven, healed, and restored to full fellowship with the One who will never reject you, never walk out on you, and never seek divorce on the grounds of irreconcilable differences." And even as Christ forgives and bears with us, He now calls us to do the same with those in our circle of friends and family who may not necessarily deserve our forgiveness, but who truly need it. And through Christ, we can give it. The ultimate forgiver lives in us.